Hello, everybody. Alex Witten here, and welcome to the Coach's Journey podcast. In this episode, I'm interviewing the amazing Chloe Garland. Chloe's the founder of Quarterlife, a company that works with individuals and organizations to help people in their 20s and 30s not just survive, but thrive through the quarterlife crisis. Quarterlife crisis is a period Chloe describes as one of intense soul searching that arrives when we're first confronted with the question of what do we do with our lives? In this episode, Chloe sheds light on the generational shifts of prolonged adolescence and how many of us encounter our first truly meaningful life choices in our mid or late 20s. In the episode, we explore how studying philosophy encouraged Chloe to ponder life's big questions. Now, from our first coaching session, age 22, she was asked some of those questions that she'd never considered before. That session left Chloe feeling ignited, and she describes the unusual experience of being called into coaching at a young age, knowing she had a gift for conversations, perhaps unaware of the profound impact she'd have on the lives of young people she'd meet along the way. There's so much I found really valuable from the conversation with Chloe. Some of the things that really stand out were the way she described living emergently, holding goals lightly, embracing opportunities to arrive. I really loved her jam donut philosophy of purpose and presence, and the discussion we had around the power of metaphors to simplify complex ideas. Chloe also talked about finding your niche, the value of niches in coaching, the idea of psychodemographics when it comes to niches. She also explores the value of shared experience in coaching and of owning our stories. I also found it really helpful and interesting having the conversation with Chloe about how do we talk about our work as coaches. Chloe also shares some really insightful lessons on growing a coaching business, reflecting on investments, outsourcing, and how the fear of success can be as much a hindrance as the fear of failure can. I first met Chloe about 6 years ago on our coaching training together, so it feels really apt that she was the guest on my first episode as part of the new team of hosts of the Coach's Journey. If you don't know anything about that new team yet, or just wondering where on earth Robbie is, if you listen back to episode 56, all will be much clearer. But without further ado, let's get into my conversation with the wonderful Chloe Garland. Chloe Garland, welcome to the Coach's Journey podcast.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here. I've listened to this podcast for so long and I'm so grateful to be invited.
I'm really excited for you to be on because as we were talking beforehand, we actually first met on a coaching training together. So really wonderful to catch up, which I think we worked out was 6 years this month.
I can't believe it.
So,
I can't believe it.
We won't count grey hairs on the call, but therefore really excited to kind of hear your journey since then. And I remember when you were doing the Mo course talking about I remember you being like, oh, really trying to find what my business is and where it will go. Lovely to hear kind of where it has gone.
Yeah, it's actually somewhat poetic that we're doing this and we literally started from ground zero. Not only at the same moment of us kind of being introduced to coaching, but also at the same age, exactly the same age. And so my first introduction to coaching was basically because I hadn't got a clue what it was that I wanted to do. I studied philosophy at university in Nottingham, and it sort of, I think that degree kind of makes and ruins people's lives because you get pretty existential about everything quite quickly. And it was good because it forces you to ask yourself loads of questions. And I think I've always been a bit of an overthinker. And I took the question of what do I want to do with my career very, very seriously. I think I'm too much of a control freak to allow myself to just fall into something. So I was quite intentional about it from the beginning. And so part of that journey was getting coaching. There was a family friend that was suggested that I spoke to, an amazing coach called Roger Evans, who I give a lot of credit to, and I'm incredibly grateful because essentially he inspired me to start coaching. And I remember sitting in his garden in his little outhouse, and it was raining and it was very atmospheric. And we spent some 2 hours together, and he just asked me quite a lot of questions that I'd never been asked before. I think I must have been about 20. 21 or 22 at the time. And I remember it so clearly. And he's like, so tell me about yourself. And I was like, oh my goodness, what do I say? And it was quite confronting, as I think everybody listening to this will maybe have a memory of their first coaching session. And I remember getting back into a car afterwards and just feeling so ignited by that conversation, and specifically a very clear moment where I thought every young adult should have access to a conversation like this. And then obviously I forgot about it and went back to uni and sort of went traveling and fell into a job. But it was always in the back of my mind of like, oh, coaching for young people. And finally, I decided to listen to my intuition, which always feels like a long time. Takes you a while to catch up with your intuition, I think. And I was introduced to Robin Chu, who's a fantastic coach and does a lot of meaningful work. And he recommended me the Mo course. And so I did it almost as a bit of a test about whether or not I want to actually do coaching. And I remember, I can't remember where we were. We were in Brentford or something.
Yeah, I think it was us when I was talking to Rob about this. I think it's like GlaxoSmithKline's, like,
yeah,
pavilion for their cricket team in Boston Manor. It was quite a bizarre, quite a cold building as well for that time of year.
Yeah, and because it was like November to January, I can't remember what it was. I remember it being cold and getting there and being quite. It was quite intimidating because I'd never done anything like that before, kind of off my own back, I suppose. And I remember sitting down in that training room and just having kind of the same feeling as when I'd had that first coaching session with Roger, which is like, this is exactly where I need to be. And that was where we met Mark and Kat, and it was just fantastic. And I think from then on, I was like, yeah, this is what I wanted to do. And so since then, because I started working in advertising, I decided then to just be like, right, I'm going to try and set up this coaching business. And I was told my parents, and they were a bit like, what? Because obviously the first response when you're 23 is, so you're going to coach people about what careers to choose, and you're 23, which I'm sure you've had similar reactions, and a lot of young coaches get that feedback. And so I moved back home, spent those first few years kind of just I trained with Animas, and then I kind of just tried everything to find clients and to learn as much as I possibly could about coaching. I was very self-conscious. I had a lot of, I guess I just really wanted to prove myself, which was something that I would probably change going back. I wish I'd accepted being a beginner for slightly longer. Honestly trying everything bar kind of putting leaflets through doors, started to get a few clients. And my company is called Quarter Life, and it's all about the quarter life crisis and helping young adults in their 20s and 30s work out what career or what life path would be most aligned to them. And as we started to gain traction, turns out there's quite a lot of young people like myself who struggled to work out their direction. And so we, and because of the name of the company Quarter Life, that was quite a useful, I didn't foresee this happening, but it was quite a useful thing that I trademarked that, because then if anyone types in the Quarter Life crisis, they'll eventually find the company, which was fantastic. And so started mostly as a one-to-one coaching business. And that was really my only ambition actually at the time, was just to do one-to-one. But as kind of life tends to do, is it has other plans and takes you in different directions. And it sort of developed. We started partnering with universities, delivering a lot of training sessions, working with different startups. We've worked with young people who are from disadvantaged backgrounds. Worked with a few great organizations, namely the Urban Scholars and the Open Private School, and providing coaching and training skills and things like that. We've also done a little bit of work in hospitals with kids with eating disorders who are on wards to help them start thinking about life outside. We didn't do a huge amount of work with them, but every year we try to go in, and it's a lovely part of what we do. And over the pandemic, we started to work with companies, and that was the kind of a big shift. So now we have two parts of the business, one part that's all about individuals and the other part's all about companies. And the aim is to try to bring coaching in from the ground up and to make coaching more accessible to young people in their 20s and 30s within organizations, dealing with things like confidence, well-being, becoming leaders for the first time. So what we do is we design programs of coaching and training. And the thing that I'm loving doing this year is bringing other coaches together and working on projects together, because coaching can be quite a lonely profession. And that's been incredibly rewarding. So that's, I suppose that's a bit of a top line as to the journey up until now. It's quite nice to reflect on it.
Thank you, Chloe. What, in that reflection, what have you noticed?
Oh, it's, I think we actually said this before we started the best laid plans. I had a sort of intention of what I wanted the coaching business to be. And then I think we have to, I always, there's a great bit of writing written by Hunter S. Thompson, and it's all about, it's a like 2 or 3 page document where he's writing to a friend. I think he was only 23 at the time when he wrote it, which is interesting because that's where we started our journey. And he talks about how there's two ways to live life. One is to swim to a goal, like have a specific goal in mind, and the other is to know who you are and kind of live more emergently. And I imagine the answer is kind of a balance between the two, but I think when I started out, I was obsessed with what's the goal, what's the end goal, where do I want the business to be. And it's a bit like saying, where do you want to live when you're 50 or 60, you know, when you're 20, 23? And it's like, we don't know. So much could happen. And so I think when I reflect on that, I noticed that I maybe learned that moving from goal, like setting goals, to living more emergently, where you're just trying to see what opportunities are available in the moment and to kind of keep your mind open rather than becoming wedded to one particular goal. Because it's almost like if you say you want to be a fireman when you're 7, by the time you're 16, that goal might be outdated. But if we become sort of addicted to the goal, we might allow opportunities to pass us by. So I think that's what I notice looking back.
And just to pause on that, we'll try and dig that Hunter S. Thompson out and put it in the show notes.
You should,
yeah. Sounds like a really good read.
It's fantastic. I actually keep it on my, it's called The Monumental Letter, I believe. I try to keep it on my desktop, and I actually send it to people after I have, if it's relevant, after initial consultation, because I just think it's fantastic. Just nail on the head. He's such an interesting human.
Really interested when you were talking about kind of how this, reading this letter, this like emergent lifestyle, in relationship to that alternative approach. And as you say, there's a balance, but the alternative being there's this goal that I'm striving and working and reaching for.
Yeah.
And how do you bring both aspects into your coaching? Because I'm aware that a big part of coaching is often, particularly for people doing their first trainings, is around setting compelling, meaningful goals.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's how you frame the goal setting as well. And I know when I set out, I had a lot of performance anxiety about making sure my clients got to the goals that they initially set out, and that I would feel useless if they didn't. And so I think it's a mindset shift on the side of the coach to not really mind if the goal changes, and to constantly be open to new things arising. I So, yeah, I definitely feel that there's a bit of a shift in that. And I notice when we're, so we've got context with people listening, but we'd have this young coaching WhatsApp group, and we often speak to people just setting out. And I don't know about you, Alex, but like I noticed that there's a lot of questions of about this, about, well, what if we don't reach the goal, and what if we kind of drift, or what if they bring loads and loads of different things each session? And I remember that really clearly. And when I hear that, I'm like, gosh, because my first reaction is like, oh, it doesn't really matter, it's fine. Now, whereas before I'd be like, oh gosh, yeah, we need to really focus in on what that specific goal is. How do you bring those two things together?
Really good question, Chloe, because I think it's a really it can be a difficult balance sometimes to that point of noticing what's your stuff in that that sometimes that inner voice or gremlin going like, am I delivering value for this person? And disassociating that sense of value from the tangible achievements of things that they're working towards, because actually some really powerful coaching might not over, you know, 3 months lead to something that they can point to and go, from this I did this.
Yeah.
But actually there's so much more that could have changed or transformed as a result, or the fact that they started and went, I want to do this. By the end, they went, oh, I didn't do that, because everything and everything they see is different.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. The I think it's about holding the goal lightly, I suppose, and just kind of being more gentle with what your goals. I have something I call the jam donut philosophy, which I really love. And it's basically where, if you imagine two circles, one outside and one in the middle, because the jam's in the middle and the dough's on the outside. And I this is just a philosophy of my that I speak to myself, but that there's two important things in life. You've got the kind of purpose, what you do, which is the dough. And then you've got the jam, which is actually just how present you are on a day to day. And that you have to choose the kind of ratio to jam and dough that you want that works for you. So some people, and I noticed this because I moved to Spain recently in the last year and a half, and I noticed this because in Barcelona, where I live, everybody's quite jam, very present, you know, living their lives really fully. When I go back to London, it's very purpose driven. It's very like, what are we doing? So people are kind of more dough. And I don't know, maybe there's, I think that obviously that again, it's the balance of the two. And I think with the goal setting, it's, we can become quite doughy people and forget that actually we need to, I don't know if this is, hopefully this is going to make some sense, but we've got to kind of keep some of that flexibility, that gooey center, rather than the rigidity of the purpose. I had a client that we were kind of coming up with this metaphor together, and we just loved it.
No, I think, well, certainly for me, makes a lot of sense, and I think resonates too. And perhaps being aware that over time your jam and dough ratio might change.
Yeah, exactly.
Metaphors is actually something that comes to mind, Chloe. As we're sort of meandering a little bit, I remember for a while you had the Monday metaphor. I'm curious how the metaphor work kind of came about and how it influences your coaching.
So I've always loved metaphors and fables. And I think it was because somebody said to me once, oh, I can really see you writing like a fable or something. I'm not very good at writing, but I'd like the idea of that a lot. And I always loved, I love those. It's a bit, I don't know if people have read like the like, for example, the Midnight Library by I think it's Matt Haig, and it's basically just like a representation of all the different lives you could have lived, and it's a person that's wandering through a library of their possible lives. And I just love how metaphors are able to help people so quickly understand something so complex, and also allow them to remember that information for such a long time, especially if it's their own metaphor. And I think it was something I learned at Mo, or even during Animas, is that if a client gives you a metaphor, it's like a gift, and you can really, I get, it's really exciting. And then when you use their metaphor back to them, you have that lovely moment where the rapport gets deeper. Not every time, but I feel like people really appreciate when you use that language. And also, metaphors have been used for thousands of years, kind of Zen cones, I think KOAN, that is what they use to help people understand. I think that's right. I might be wrong there, but and then obviously in the Bible, and a lot of religious texts and a lot of philosophy, people use metaphors to help understand things, and a lot of like great wisdom. When I studied philosophy, we did a lot of about Eastern philosophy as well, and the like Taoist philosophy. It's basically just a book of poetry, which is all metaphorical. And it kind of helps you to go behind your logical brain and to think sort of slightly more deeply and more intuitively about something. So I have a sort of side project-ish that's been going on for a while where I'm trying to collect metaphors. And I would love one day to have a little, I don't know, like a coffee table book or a book where you have different metaphors for different categories in different parts of your life. That help understand things, because I've just collected so many from clients, from other coaches, from people that I've maybe I can put the jam donut philosophy in there, although it might seem a bit silly.
I'd have thought that would be the first page.
Okay, amazing.
yeah really interesting though, kind of slowing down on that sense of how imagery, analogy, metaphors almost have like a have the ability to be resonant at a level that sort of explicit words sometimes aren't, because I think they share the essence of something in a way that is hard to articulate sometimes. I remember reading an article, I think it was maybe by a therapist, who was talking about how quite often as our experience and feelings come to language, the first step is often analogy and metaphor as we actually begin to find the words for it. But really interesting, because it feels like there is that, if someone gets your metaphor, you suddenly feel understood at a level that if you go, oh, I'm feeling challenged at the moment or tired, it doesn't necessarily feel like it has that same resonance.
Yeah, it's deeply personal in a way. It's I wonder why. I guess maybe because we are sort of more imaginary creatures than we think we are. And as you say, it might resonate from sort of slightly deeper level. So when somebody understands that, you therefore resonate with them at a slightly deeper level. But yeah, they're just, it's, as I say, it's such a gift when people come up with their own.
You touched on some of that philosophy background. It seemed like it was quite a big influence in the move towards coaching and, forcing you to question things. And I wonder, in what way is that philosophical training, maybe for want of better words, continued or contributed or influences the work you do now?
I only did an undergrad in philosophy, but I remember in one of the first lectures that I went into, the title of the lecture was, Do We Have Hands? And I remember walking out and being like, oh my God, I've got to spend the next 3 years talking about whether or not we have hands. But essentially it was a lecture on, can you prove the existence of an external reality? And essentially, there's like this whole philosophical debate that you can't, because we could technically be brains in vats being manipulated by super scientists. And now for anybody who, that's a bit, so I know how that sounds. And that was my reaction to that when I first went into philosophy, was like, just shut, like the shutters came down, and it was really like, this is just, what am I doing? Like, let's go and try and change my degree. But I remember having a realization of which was, if I do that for the rest of my life, and if I continue to not be open-minded, then I'm not going to learn anything. And that was probably the thing from the degree that I learnt that was the most impactful, because suddenly you start to kind of open, you entertain things that maybe you didn't before. And I think that has, I hope that that has helped with being more open-minded to maybe other people's realities and other people's experiences of realities and the lenses through which they see the world. And again, I hope that I'm just sort of making connections. Maybe there aren't any here, but I hope that it has just made me a little less wedded to my own opinions. And I think that's another thing that also you learn in the essay writing or philosophy. You have to be very careful of your biases, and that's a real central focus in like writing philosophical essays. So I think that's one thing. And I think the other thing is an interest in sort of the kind of existential side of philosophy. And recently I've been doing a bit more reading and learning about existential coaching, mostly through Yannick Jacob's work, who's just epic. And it's been really interesting to read, because it makes me reflect on the fact that the whole quarter-life crisis, which often people somewhat roll their eyes at, I think, I don't know, hopefully not now, but I know some people kind of roll their eyes a little bit about that. It is actually an existential question. Well, and maybe sometimes the first time people ask themselves a bit of an existential question of like, what am I doing? Why am I here? This isn't right. So what is right? And where do I find meaning? And I think that's why I find it so interesting. And I've only just kind of put those connections together recently, because it's not just what career do I want to choose or where do I want to be? It's more like, why am I here? What's the point? And so I think that maybe has come through from the philosophy too.
Those different realities and that are therefore, I suppose, being able to hold ours lightly and be present to others. You just touched on it, Chloe, the quarter life crisis, which seems like and sounds like central to your work. It's part of the name of your business. Just very quickly for listeners who might not be that familiar with it or who've just heard it in passing, what is the quarter life crisis?
So it's a period, I always say it's like a period of sort of intense soul searching that happens usually in your 20s and 30s. Where I think it's the first time you're kind of confronted with the question of what do I want to do with my life? And it's often accompanied by a lot of feelings of anxiety or a lack of confidence, a lack of clarity. Often people can feel a lot of option paralysis of, oh my goodness, there are so many options, I don't know which one to choose. And although I focus a lot on it being around careers, because I found that the majority of the crises has been career related, it could be anything. It could be a feeling of being trapped by a relationship or a community or a country or even just where you live. Like rent prices, finance. It's essentially just a feeling like I'm not happy with my current situation, and I need a change, but I don't know what that change is. And so people can feel quite locked in, and this can happen at any point in your life. The quarter life is just interesting because it could be just one of the first times it's happened, and there's sort of a particular combination of pressures that happen, especially towards your late 20s, where this sort of, you know, we've got to have it all figured out by, I think there's a number of reasons why quarter life crisis is maybe more acute now. One of those reasons is I've got to make the right choice. There is a right choice that's available to me. Because I think we see all these people living their best lives on social media. And so we think, I've just got to try and find that one right thing. And I think we forget that actually what's more important than making the choice is what you do after the choice has been made. So that's the first thing. I think second thing is, as I say, the option paralysis. From an app in our phone, we can see an infinite number of possible partners, possible jobs, possible places to live. Option paralysis is that feeling of like when you go to a restaurant and there's loads of things on the menu and it's like, oh, I don't know what to choose. So sometimes you just kind of pick something random or you don't pick anything at all. And then I think the third thing that's making it a little bit more challenging for people is the comparison, social media's comparison with everybody else. We can see other people's lives so clearly and so frequently. And we've evolved to compare ourselves. It was once useful to kind of keep work out the pecking order of a tribe, but now that tribe extends to the whole world because we can see the whole world online. We're constantly second guessing ourselves. Is this what I want, and is this what I should do? And I think just to kind of also just caveat everything that I've just said, it's also really important to note that the quarter life crisis is a luxury. And it's a privileged issue in that maybe, I don't know what percentage is, but there's a very small percentage of the population of the world that can even question what they want to do and take things like job satisfaction and fulfillment into consideration. And it's a new issue. I think that maybe 50, 100 years ago, again, it's a similar thing, is that you did what was in front of you. Jobs were maybe more about survival. It is something that is only kind of afforded to very few people.
Sounds like a big theme there, though, is this, I suppose, luxury of choice, but also then that responsibility or burden of choice, in a sense that something that we might not have previously had, we have to now make in an environment where we can see way more options than previously. It'd be like being given a dinner menu at a restaurant that's 1,000 pages long and going, well, which one do you want, while looking at all the food around the restaurant.
It's like supermarkets as well, the classic example. And I think that I think it was Einstein that came up with the option paralysis thing. He wore the same suit his whole life because he knew that we get decision fatigue. And essentially, when there's too many options, we think the probability of taking the wrong choice is greater. And everybody goes through it. I think we've always struggled with the question of what do you want to do when you're old? I actually read a letter from my grandfather to his father when I think he was coming back from the war, and he was trying to work out what he did when he came back. And he was asking the same questions. Like, I don't know what to do, and I don't know which option to choose. And his dad was sort of trying to help him. And it was just kind of interesting to be like, oh, it is something that has always people have found challenging. Actually, another variable maybe that's making it harder is time. I think we have a bit more time. I think another thing is that we have this sort of prolonged adolescence. Generally, people are staying at home for longer or studying for longer. And so often the first meaningful decision that we have to take about our own lives, where we have to take responsibility for, is in our late 20s or our mid 20s. And we're almost not used to taking responsibility for our choices, because maybe we've had the ecosystem of a school or a university or your families to help us with that. And I think I always say to people when we're starting the coaching, if it's one-to-one, that you could relabel the career coaching as decision-making coaching, because essentially that's what it is. And I always say, ironically, people generally tend to know exactly what they want to do when they come to the coaching. Well, they have an inkling. So it's actually that there's something holding them back. There's a bit of fear, or I'm afraid that I'm going to make the wrong decision, and then I'm going to be the one that's responsible for that.
So it's that balance of being given options, but also being given the reins at the same time. So the outcomes of these options are solely on you, at least the feeling of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
It seems strange to me, but I think we can sometimes get caught in some narratives that are potentially belittling of the quarter life crisis, or to the point you mentioned, the fact that it is a luxury. But First, to speak to that, it strikes me that there's a real opportunity if you're able to navigate that in a kind of fulfilling way. But I mean, from your experience, Chloe, what is the power of being able to navigate the quarter life crisis?
I love that you use the word opportunity. Somebody asked me a sort of similar question once, and I said that I'd love to re-label the quarter life crisis as the quarter life opportunity, but it doesn't quite sound as catchy. But I think that's basically what it is. It's fundamentally a moment in your life where people are taking control of what their story, and the kind of, I guess, tagline that we have in course life is write your own story, be the author of your own narrative. Don't procrastinate choosing, because if you do that, either circumstance or somebody else will write it for you. That just kind of seems, the amount of people that I hear, oh, I just fell into that. That will happen if we're not intentional or somewhat intentional about the choices that we're making. So I think it's a rite of passage in some ways. I think we all have a sort of crisis, like this quarter life opportunity or crisis at some point in our lives. It just affects people in different ways due to a number of different circumstances that they might be in. But it's such an exciting, and I try to kind of bring that more excited energy to it, because it's a really exciting moment. And often it's people breaking free from their parents. It's people breaking free from societal expectation. It's breaking free of all the shoulds that maybe constrict them and prevent them from doing actually what they really want to do. And it's a privilege. I think all coaching is such a privilege, and any sort of talking profession is such a privilege, because you get the opportunity to witness somebody's unfolding. And I'm in awe, because a lot of people sadly don't live with the kind of dissatisfaction. They live with the background dissatisfaction because they think, oh, it's just nothing. This is just the way that it is. And so I think this especially why I love it at the kind of quarter life age, is because it's right at the beginning of your life. So you've got so much time, and you've got a bit more flexibility. So you can, maybe you don't have the same responsibilities as you do if you're slightly old. I mean, I think the key message though is that you can always make a change, but it's just like you've got a little bit more flexibility. Originally, when I started, I thought I would do the coaching mostly for university leavers or school leavers. But actually, when you're in the mid-20s to late 20s or early 30s, you've got a bit more experience, a bit more data about what you like and dislike. So I think it's actually the perfect time to think about what you want. And I always think about your 20s as being your workshop years, where you're kind of working out. And so you don't have to have it all figured out. We have to remember that everything is shifted. So we're living longer, we're having children later, we're working for longer, we're studying for longer. So we have a bit more time, and yet we're still measuring ourselves up against this sort of 30 moment where we get to 30 and we've got to have like the house, the partner, and the career. And I really believe that we've got a little bit more time, and that we can define what that success looks like. But it's hard. It's hard because those are the things, especially those three things, especially where I grew up in London, it's like drilled into you in some ways, not by anybody, but just by the society in general. So it can be quite disorienting when you create your own definitions for success rather than using the kind of blueprint that is set out for you.
Oh, you talked at the very beginning in terms of almost like your first, where you first came across coaching was in a garden with Roger Evans. And then that journey to quarter life, your business. But yeah, I'm really curious on kind of what got you from that experience of coaching, you mentioned that role in advertising, to the quarter life crisis as the focus of your work?
I think it was purely personal experience. It's some of the stuff that often we cover in coaching is like trying to work out what purpose means to you and where you get a sense of purpose from. And we do something called like the hurt to heal exercise sometimes, which is like trying to reflect on what maybe some any challenging things that you've been through, or challenges that you may have been through growing up, or in the present moment, or challenges that you see outside of yourself that really, really deeply impact you, things that make you angry as well. And I think it was purely because I went through that period of not knowing what I wanted to do, and really like feeling the strain of that, and hearing so many people who were struggling to choose their path and navigate those first few years of your career, that weirdly the niche that I have focused on kind of came before the coaching. Because I know that, and so I was quite lucky, because when I went into doing my coaching course, I know a lot of people would check, what's my niche, you know, because they chose to be a coach before they chose a niche. So mine was strangely the other way around, whereas I knew that from the beginning. And so one thing, if there's a coach also trying to find their niche, it's quite a good question to ask yourself, is like, what's my story? I've often found, and this is definitely not universally true, but I've often found you end up kind of coaching yourself, and that the your niche often becomes, maybe we're all quite egotistical, our niche kind of all becomes something that you've been through because you feel personally connected to it. So you kind of always feel that drive to help something because you get it. So it's quite useful to kind of go back and be like, well, what have I been curious about? Do you have a niche of coaching clients?
It's a really good question, because I was about to sort of throw back that, because that's a really interesting debate within coaching, of should you niche? My short answer is probably, which isn't that short, but where I find my work focusing and probably narrowing more and more is, but it's very broad and abstract, is people seeking to live more authentic, connected lives. Whether that's creating positive change in their life or the world, I feel like they're probably one and the same, actually. Partly noticing that for me, some of the best work I've done has been for people where you couldn't unify in any other thing than potentially their kind of that aspiration, which is less tangible than, oh, they work in this industry. Or I think someone might have once called like psychodemographics, so that idea of, those, what are the common challenges or questions that they're bringing. And that's been fascinating, but also it's a really interesting one, because am I just procrastinating, setting my like my flag in the sand and going, actually, this is where I'm going to do my coaching for the next sort of 4 or 5 years. Really interesting to hear that for you that niche came first.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know whether we need one. I think it's useful for marketing, but somebody once said something to me before about the niche thing, which was that, well, two things. One, that it generally tends to find you, that when you start coaching, I don't know whether you found this, you start to notice that the same like issues or challenges or people tend to gravitate towards you. And it's not the be all and end all, I think, if you don't have a niche. It just can be quite useful to market. Oh, this is the second thing that they told me, that even if you say that, okay, my niche is coaching women between the ages of 20 to 30 around confidence, you'll still get somebody come through who's a man in his 40s wanting to talk about his career, and then you can be like, oh, it just happens. You get people that come through, and so it, it's not like that. You're sort of doomed to only coach one type of person. That you still, it's just quite useful just for kind of marketing purposes. So it doesn't have to be, you know, you're not, your niche doesn't make you stuck.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really sound point. And to add to that, it makes it much easier to talk about, particularly as you start to talk about coaching, because it firstly, lots of people go, what on earth is that? And then secondly, if you can go, well, I coach these people through this thing, it can be really. And coincidentally, recently, a couple of people have got in touch going, I hear you're a career coach. I've never put those words together. And and so it shows how in the way you describe your work, people will make their own kind of inferences of, oh, this could be really valuable for this person in this way.
Yeah. How do you describe what you do to people that don't know about coaching? And not people interested in coaching, but like people at the pub who are saying, oh, so what do you do?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question that I don't know, navigate in different ways. So I'd be curious for you. In some ways, I almost wish we could get rid of the word coaching and come up with a completely new word.
I know.
Because I don't know. I mean, obviously sport has kind of taken coaching, but also I think now lots of jobs take coaching when you're actually maybe a tutor or a mentor or program coordinator. But anyway, that's my little pet peeve at the moment. How I usually do it now, though, is actually I ask people, you know, what do you know about coaching? If they say nothing, like what might you think it's about? And then there's often the challenge of, it's sometimes easy to go, well, what it's not is mentoring, because then you can pull out the piece of a mentor has often probably got a similar experience and is therefore imparting their advice. And it's not therapy, because while there's a lot of commonality in the way we might listen, coaching is more often future focused and directional. But often how I've heard it before, which I really love the analogy of, mentoring is potentially someone sort of standing in front of you and guiding you along a path, whereas coaching, you're walking side by side with someone and helping them see more clearly both the path around them and the next step.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, really nice. It's really hard. It's still hard to define it. And I love your way of defining it, because it's the most coaching way of being like, well, I'm going to ask you what you think it is. I usually just say, I usually try to just say what the outcome of the coaching is. So I help people work out what, you know, career to choose, or I help companies sort of support and develop their young. And then maybe they'll go, like, oh, so how do you do that? Oh, through coaching. So maybe just starting with the outcome and working backwards. I sometimes do that. It seems to, because yeah, the coaching conversation is very difficult to define. Everyone has a different way.
I do think that's a really powerful point, though, is that coaching is a means or a method in a way. It's not, in the same, you know, a builder wouldn't go, just I build. You'd be like, well, what do you build? So actually,
exactly.
I build houses. And you go,
exactly.
How have you found that, Chloe, as someone that's, I'd probably say, it's atypical at the time in their life when they started their coaching career. How have you found the response to saying, I work as a coach? And then I imagine that how you've just defined your work has evolved over time.
Yeah. Well, at the beginning, I don't know whether this is true, but my sense of the coaching industry in the last, when I first started, I didn't know many other coaches, in their 20s, doing, because I think even on our course, we were in the Mo course, we were one of the only two. Well, I don't remember actually, but I know now that there's so many people who are becoming coaches as their first, second, third career. So that's changed quite a lot. So I think it's a bit more normal. But I know that when I first started, it was quite challenging, because I think a lot of the advice was, you need to go and get a proper job before you start. And you know, it's probably good advice, but I didn't listen. I think I was just, there was nothing else I would rather have done. So whereas I think now it's a little bit more, it's actually swung probably the opposite way. I think on one of the young coaches calls that we did recently, somebody described having the ick about the coaching industry, which is, for anybody who doesn't know what the ick is, it's when you get like an irreversible feeling of distaste towards somebody, usually in like a dating context, just because they've done one thing. And that because now so many people are saying that they're coaches, and Instagram, the rise of the kind of Instagram coach and the three-step plan to be confident or to find the love of your life or whatever. Unfortunately, people think coaching, and they there's a lot of people that think that's what it is. So yeah, that's something to navigate now, I think. But at the beginning, it was a little bit challenging because I think people just didn't really understand what it was and couldn't understand, especially the young person, how you could exist in this field or show up in this field in a meaningful way. I remember finding that quite challenging, and it was so, my idea of what I wanted to do was so fragile, it was so delicate, and that I remember it would take one person to kind of look at you a bit like, okay, and I would just feel crushed, because also I didn't have the confidence of years of experience, but life experience anyway. So I think that was the thing that was quite difficult, is that you speak to people, they would not really get it, and then you would start to doubt yourself. And I think the only thing that I guess the reason maybe why I kept going was actually naivety, was not really, I think if I had to start a coaching business now, it would be very different. It's a bit like going skiing. If you've ever been skiing, a few times that I've been, like, you go when you're a child, you like bomb down the slopes, or if you go rollerblading or whatever, and then when you get a bit older, you're so aware of what could go wrong that suddenly you're, I remember the next time I went, I must have been like 16 and or at university, and I was really nervous. And so I think it's probably the same kind of thing, that when you're young, you don't really know what could go wrong.
There's something really powerful in that, almost like childlike. That's to use your word, naivety. Like, I'll just throw myself in. But how did you then, with that naivety, still manage that kind of crushing feeling of those times where the response you got wasn't positive?
I think it's so difficult to know, but I think it was just because I really loved the coaching, and I kept going back to the feeling of like being coached by Roger and being in Mo and doing my courses and and just there was nothing else that I could think of that I would want to do. So even the knocks weren't enough to put me off, because I really and I thought about it a lot. And I got coaching on it, and I'd reflected so much on what I've always enjoyed doing ever since I was a kid. I'd loved having like what I thought were really deep conversations, and probably weren't in hindsight, but I always really loved talking to people and hearing people's stories, and it just made so much sense in my mind from a kind of a personal standpoint of what I like to do. But also I really believed in the idea. So even when at a time that other people couldn't quite see it, I felt like I felt like I didn't really have another option, because there was nothing else which was nice.
Almost the inverse quarter life crisis,
exactly,
this one. But to that, there sounds like some really insightful things for people exploring coaching, in that, you know, yeah, still ensuring that you're engaging with it in a way that reminds you why it matters, so that, you know, when you face setbacks, which are inevitable in whatever thing you're pursuing, you're still connected to that why, or to the value of the why you're doing it. Whether that be receiving coaching yourself to be able to navigate that challenge, or to be able to like think about it or have the space to just do it. I remember for me, one of the, I love this, but I've been doing a MO course at the moment, and obviously a big part of like listening like a coach is not relating, but because this isn't coaching, I can do it. So thanks, Mo. But the thing that jumped out for me is that noticing the things that I found hardest in coaching is inviting people to coaching, sharing my work, because there's a real vulnerability there for me. But realizing that it's always easier after I've had a great coaching session or I've done some coaching, because I'm like, oh yeah, this is what I want to give someone else. Like, wouldn't it be great if other people had it?
Yeah.
But really probably just echoes that point you were making, Chloe, of the value of, yes, there's going to be real challenge in anything that we want to pursue. So make sure that you give yourself the opportunity to remind yourself in whatever way it is of why you're doing this.
I'm going to steal yours. Like, that's also because you have an amazing coaching session and it like completely floors you, and you just wonder how anybody can do anything without having a coach at some point. My coach is a completely changed my trajectories, like my mindset on things, and that's such a good point, that often the thing that has tided me through has been just being coached and just being like, yeah, wow, this is I want to be like my coach, I want to have the same experience of what they're giving me to other people.
I think they're probably more implicit or more, it's easy to be aware that there's definitely some real challenges in setting up as a coach, as a young person. And you notice that more people are doing it, I suppose. I think there's probably some real benefits that would be really interesting to explore. But before that, are there any other challenges that felt really resonant to you as, quote unquote, a young person starting a coaching business?
The first was other people's reactions and just not quite buying it, and when it's fragile that can be quite damaging. I think the second thing is probably just not, it was probably confidence, because my confidence in general was developing in your early 20s and mid 20s, and you're still you're on your personal development, you're on your own personal development journey. And I think that I see other people setting up their coaching practices now, having been in different industries, and they can grow their businesses quite quickly. I think I had quite a slow start because I was just I really didn't know what the etiquette was of sending emails and all these things. I kind of had to try to figure that out by myself. So there was just so much stuff that I didn't have experience of. But it's interesting because I often say this, that the thing that people thought was my, the weakness, which was being younger, was also the strength, because actually, weirdly, the clients that I worked with, they really loved that I was going through and had been through a similar thing, even though that's not really what coaching is about. It's just there was this like real non-judgmental attitude and like a real understanding that, and I think people felt like they were being taken seriously rather than kind of dragged through, like, you know, get over it, which I'm sure not many coaches would do. But I think it was just that extra layer of understanding. So there was a lot of things. There's a lot of things about, like, I find just personally setting up a business and it being super slow at the beginning and not earning much money, whilst all my friends were getting these big jobs and progressing, and I was there like, I don't know if this is gonna, I really didn't know if it was going to even work out. And so I had to kind of constantly battle that uncertainty and, you know, living at home. And I just felt like that was prolonged. And again, it's that comparison. I was experiencing a lot of the things that I speak to my clients about, which is comparing myself to others. Is actually what I want to do. I think the most vulnerable period for a coach and also for any business owner is that period where you're putting in so much effort, but you're not getting any rewards. So you're not getting any money or you're not getting any good feedback. And so you have to continually rely on your own motivation. And that is exhausting. And so that to experience that whilst you're also in your early 20s, I remember that there was a lot of stress. I was quite stressed in the first few years for sure.
I think it's something that's so easily forgotten. If someone says I work as a coach, is that they're also saying I'm a business owner of some sort. And all of the things that go behind that. But something that jumped out to me there, Chloe, was you were talking about that. People find it reassuring for you that, you know, you're going through this experience with them. I think there's a really interesting thing, because obviously coaches aren't the expert, but actually almost recognizing that it is valuable to still own our own experience, because it's a really scary and courageous act to reach out to a coach, and actually therefore there's probably going to be slightly easier to do if it's someone that you feel a connection with because they might have shared experience. And even if that doesn't show up at all in the coaching, it's still just being confident to hold that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just what you said there is one of the most powerful things is your story. And especially when it even comes to marketing yourself and selling coaching, to share with people what your story is, it like humanizes you, and I think it is quite an important to be authentic and honest about what your story is. People can, I think that's how you really build rapport especially at the beginning. Because ultimately it's just connection with another human being, and it's very difficult to do that if you're just doing coaching and you're not sharing anything about yourself, even just at the beginning, about who you are and how you coach and what your kind of values are.
How do you do that, Chloe, at sharing your story, sharing you authentically?
It's very difficult, because when you share your story so many times, it can suddenly start to feel like you're reading off an auto cue. And so I try each time to preface it by saying just that, of like, I share my story so much, I want to make sure that I'm sharing it in the most honest way that I can, that isn't just me being like, okay, and then I did this, and then I did this. And so I usually start by saying that. And I try to kind of feel what is intuitive in the moment, rather than just go through the kind of the 1, 2, 3, this is what I've done. But I usually share, maybe, I don't think I have a huge amount about me on the website, maybe like a little bio, but usually when I'm doing like a discovery call, I will hear their story, I'll ask them loads of questions, and then before I explain a little bit about coaching and what I do, I will just say, I would share a little bit about myself and my journey into coaching, and how I got to be where I am here, but now. And I think people respond to it, because then suddenly it's like, okay, we're two different people. And I think it also takes people off, because I know there's a kind of coaching pedestal. You can think your coach has it all sorted, and I think it's a really nice opportunity to share some vulnerability, and again to create that equality of the relationship.
Yeah, and I think there's a really powerful point there in creating that sense of equals. Because you say, particularly when you're wanting to facilitate someone else's thinking, just reminding them that, you know, we're working this out together. I don't have the answers for you.
Yeah, but well, maybe that's why the young coaches coaching other young people. I listened to a podcast recently that talked about we need to stop calling people in their 20s young, because actually like we're like the adults. and if you're you know 21, 18 and above, you're an adult, and you're responsible for making your own choices. I think we also live in a society where like we call millennials young adults, and the oldest millennials are like in their 40s. And I think it's actually a bit of a issue, and I'm saying this as I'm speaking now because I think I've got language on my website that maybe I need to update, is that young, like using the term young people to talk about people in their 20s and 30s is almost like kind of perpetuating the issue of like, oh, these people, they like this adolescence and they don't really know what they're doing, and it's giving us almost an out. Like, no, we're capable of making our own decisions and being responsible. So I'm going to try to reframe as much as I can, rather than saying young people, like those in their 20s and 30s, adults in their 20s and 30s. Maybe I need to do some work on my copy.
I think it's a really good catch. I think because as you say, it's all about, I suppose, being a decision maker, or making decisions. Kind of full responsibility for the first time in life.
Absolutely.
And also it's that point of age might be irrelevant then. You could be before 18 and be in that situation, or it could be, as you said, like later 20s, 30s.
And think about that. I mean, my grandmother, she had kids when she was 19, and they're fully independent, working. So we have the capability to be, to be independent, actualized people. I think there's a sense that like the Gen Z and millennials are kind of almost like babied by us and also others. It's kind of an interesting one.
That's almost that whole kind of, we live up to the labels we're given in some ways, or the expectations that the language we use creates.
Exactly. So this gives me some good, I think I need to do some updating.
Well, for anyone listening to the show, you'll see Chloe's website and you'll see there's no reference to young people. Maybe there is, maybe in a full 180.
Yeah.
360. Thinking about, you kind of touched on the, talking about that quarter life crisis and that point of potentially when it could happen is a broader period in life, we might have thought, in terms of we're living longer, the point at which we probably take full responsibility for our lives is later. It makes me think of a question that Alex Swallow, who's a member of the Coaches Journey community, asked. And community members can put questions forward, and his was around kind of what, if any, trends do you notice in terms of that career intention for people you work with. So his reflection that was, what he worked in the charity sector, and by the time he was in his late 20s, sort of 10 years out of university, he had people coming to him interested in understanding what it might involve doing kind of social good or charity work. And noticing a movement of people going into roles that with the big incentive being income, moving towards sort of impacts. And what, if any, trends or themes you notice in the people that come to you looking for that career change?
Yeah, the key word is fulfillment, that I hear a lot all the time, actually. I think I use that on my website quite a lot because I know that that's often what people will like, almost come and get a bit of a game. It's like, how quickly is somebody going to say the word fulfillment or purpose in a sort of discovery initial call? And I don't know whether that's just because I have a bit of a skewed data set, because people obviously come to coaching because I generally don't get people. Well, actually, that's not necessarily true. I was going to say, I generally don't get people saying, oh, I just want to earn more money, but that's not true. But they're definitely, from the people that I've spoken to, are looking for more purpose and fulfillment in their work. But it's interesting because lifestyle is also really important, I've noticed, to people. And I think people from the again, the kind of skewed data set that I've experienced, will have an idea of, I want to do a really purposeful, impactful job. And then they kind of do a little bit of exploration, informational interviews, and then they're like, ooh, actually, I don't want to give up my lifestyle, and completely fair enough. So it's really, really important. I found that if you say, okay, I really want a more like purposeful, impactful career, that you are also honest with yourself about like what you want your life to look like. Now, that's sort of prefaced with the assumption that you can't have both. And that's not true either. I think one of the things that we often feel is that it's like either passion or it's pay, or it's purpose or it's pay. And either I work for a bank or I work for a charity. And obviously there's like a whole range. I think coaching is a good example of being able to help people, but also like have a good lifestyle and be able to support ourselves. There's a whole range, spectrum of opportunities that you can do that are within within the kind of pay, passion, profit spectrum. So and ideally we want to find something that does both, but you just have to be so honest with yourself about what kind of life you want to live, and make sure that the career that you choose gives you that. Because you could be doing the most a dream job, but if you can't pay your rent, or you can't, I don't know, go do the things that you want to do, it will turn anybody sour. And so it's actually one of the first things that I ask people, which is like, where do you sit on a spectrum? On a scale of 0 to 10, a 10 being somebody whose life is their work, who works, lives to work, somebody like a priest or an activist, or you can't disseminate between their work. And a 0 is, I can just do something. I don't mind what I do, as long as it pays me enough so that I can go and do my things on the weekend and have a nice lifestyle. And I always ask people like where they are on that spectrum. And that gives us a good sense of, okay, what does the career need to do for you? So I think, yes, generally people have come for fulfillment, but there's a sense check experience that we need to go through to just be like, hey, make sure that fulfillment is really important, as long as it also doesn't sacrifice our non-negotiables.
Yeah. I think I like something that probably can often be like is implicit but missed in the sort of term career coaching, is underneath that career is that fulfillment piece, and almost that question of what's the life you want your career to contribute to, and really working that out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, and that can be quite challenging, because I think we sort of think we should want to save the world, and but it's, again, it's that should thing. So we've got to be so careful of not living our lives based on what other people think, or what we think is like the right thing to do for our parents or for society in general. Like, we've got to be really, really brutally honest. And sometimes that can be incredibly uncomfortable, because I've had some people that come and they're like, yeah, I want to live a career that's all about helping others. And actually we dig into that, and they're like, you know what? I just want to go on a nice holiday a couple times a year. And then that brings up a lot of stuff. Or a classic one is, I want to earn loads of money, and actually digging into that and being like, well, you know, it's not as important. That's more an extrinsic value, something that depends on how other people perceive you. It's an identity question. This is why I said to you before, I think it's something I've recently realized why I'm so interested in this period, because I guess two things. Number one, it's not just about career, it's like your identity. Like, who are you, and what career would best reflect as much as possible who you are? And that can be really uncomfortable and challenging for people to go into, because maybe who they are isn't what they think they are. So there's a lot of acceptance work that needs to come into that. And then the second one is that it's, as I said at the beginning, it's this existential question of people start thinking about their careers and they realize, hold on, I'm not getting fulfillment from this. I thought I was going to, because I was paying great and it looks great on the CV and everybody says that I'm doing a great job. And yet I still feel somewhat like empty. And that then can sometimes be a catalyst to force us into, okay, well, if this isn't it, if I'm doing something, especially if you've been a hyperachiever and you've really achieved, if this isn't what life's about, and I've achieved that, and like, what is it? What am I here for? Is it about my career in general? Sometimes it can be the thing that kind of pushes us into asking these really big questions. And so in the coaching, it's really interesting because then we start from the big questions. If the client feels, or you can sort of sense that that's where they want to go, you can start from like, right, why are we here? And what's looking, you know, but looking back over our lives, what is it that we would like to be able to say about our existence and ourselves? And I asked a question to a client the other day that was like something like, if you had to explain beyond sort of the biological procreation and that kind of thing, you had to explain to an alien what the point is, what would you say? And it was just like so interesting that was coming up in a career coaching conversation. Like, we get, because then once you kind of created your own philosophy, you can then start to think, okay, well then if it's all about giving back, or if it was all about experiences, if it's all about family, then you can go into where your career sits in that framework. It's all about giving back. Okay, well then maybe it's about doing a career that means that you can give 10% of your salary, or maybe it is doing a career where you are giving, or maybe it's just doing a career that supports your family. So it's just really fascinating what doors it can open and where it can lead. It's, yeah, endlessly interesting.
As you describe that now, Chloe, I think really highlights how beautifully broad but powerful both coaching can be, and some of the questions it can help people answer. When you were finishing that Mo course and moving towards coaching, like, how does the conversation you're describing now compare to what you imagined it could be?
Oh my gosh. it's so different. I mean, I think I would be really happy if I knew that part of my job and part of my calling it a job makes it sound, I don't know, it doesn't seem right in some ways, but like part of my life would be to be able to have these kinds of conversations with people. And when I first started, it was very much like, okay, careers, what ideas, like let's come up with ideas and values, and which is super valuable. But the fact that it's evolved into not all the time, but that it can evolve into these like really like fundamental questions. I think my 23-year-old self when we met, Alex, would be fantastic, you know. I would be really excited by that. And it's really nice, actually, and I appreciate asking the question. It's really nice to reflect on it's coming up now. I'm sort of like, it's as always, it's very difficult to reflect as we go. That's why these conversations and my coaching conversations are so powerful, because it enables you to also reflect on that sometimes the life that you're living is something that you would have been really inspired by, or aspects of the life that you're living would have been really inspired by. So yeah, it's really nice to look back.
I think there's two things that really jump out to me there. One being that point you said that these questions don't always come up in coaching sessions, and it goes back to that point you're saying about realities, and that a great coaching conversation doesn't have to be at this incredibly profound or abstract level. To still be of incredible service to that individual. And I think it can sometimes, as coaches, we can go, oh, but we didn't really talk about what it really means. And that can be absolutely fine. Which is a very, very small point you mentioned, but that felt resonant to me. The other thing that really stood out as well is that sense of, I think, joy and satisfaction in the fact that these conversations are present, but that point of, you know, we don't often pause and recognize what's going on, I think is a real challenge in fresh mind coaching, where for a lot of coaches, it's, I need to get this business to a sort of level of sustainability and then it will all be great. Actually, then it's how much of that journey is missed or not fully kind of experienced in that kind of struggle to go, oh, I've got to sort of sustainability.
Yeah, absolutely.
And unintentionally, kind of segues nicely into before we were recording, Chloe, you talked about that feeling of like creating a thriving coaching business. And earlier you were talking about the challenge of having to work a lot of it out yourself because it was really the first big career path you chose to go down. Mm. You didn't necessarily have those business networks or professional connections. Mm. So starting from scratch. So what stands out as the things that have been really invaluable on that journey to getting you to where you are as a coach who, like, their business is thriving or is contributing to a thriving life?
Yeah. So at the beginning, as I kind sort of alluded to, that I just tried everything, and you've got to put pride aside and you just try everything. When it came to, I remember doing like Facebook groups, talks, all sorts of things, sending emails to friends of friends about what I'm doing, and I remember posting it on my personal social media pages, which was terrifying, and then like trying kind of B2B partnerships going in, and basically I remember once going on Wikipedia to try to find every single university in London where I was living at the time, and sent an email out to every single uni. You're like, hey, this is what I'm doing. And actually from that, I got a response from an amazing university, which was then called the New College of the Humanities. And they responded, and it was an amazing head of careers there called Matthew. I don't think he's there. No, he's not there anymore. And he kind of gave me a shot. I went in and sort of pitched to him what I was doing. And he was like, okay, well, why don't you coach some of our students? And that was literally just from sheer relentlessness and just trying loads of different things, and kind of as I say, sort of chucking up against the wall, seeing what stuck. I think if I was to go back and try and be a bit more intentional about what I was doing, I think I would have, because the most powerful thing I've found is just obviously word of mouth, people's testimonials. I think I would have just done like 10, 15 coaching series or sessions, and done more in return for like video testimonials and written testimonials, and just done that for a little bit. I think I was quite scared of asking people for that. But since then, I mentioned to you that I have been doing a group, turning the career coaching program, the individual one, into a group program. And so we did a pilot this year, and it was great because as a repayment for the group program, they didn't have to pay so much, but then they would have to give me like feedback and reviews and all these kinds of things. And that's been great in terms of advertising it again for the second time. So that's something I really wish I'd tried more of. Again, I was quite sort of fortunate in that the name of the business, Quarter Life, if ever a journalist is wanting to write about the quarter life crisis, not all the time, but eventually they might come across the website. And so there was a few articles that we were featured in. Some of them did nothing, and then others. There was one particular article that came out at exactly the right time and exactly the right publication, I think, and that really was like sort of the start of the business, I felt. So, and that was kind of random how they found us, and then so it was just like, that first couple of years, it was just like, just keep trying all these different things, and eventually the momentum starts. And also another thing that I did that was really powerful was to make, essentially, without realizing, I sort of made friends with a lot of my competitors in some ways, people in the industry that were doing similar things to me. And we've created a bit of a network. And then referral systems started happening. Maybe somebody went, I don't know, on maternity leave, or maybe somebody wanted to take a step back or were overwhelmed with clients. And they would start sending me people. And that really helped build my confidence and got more, again, more testimonials. So that was something that I have found really powerful, in that there's actually Caitlin Hall, who's one of the coaches in our Young Coaches group, Alex, we're each other's accountability partner. She's an amazing career coach. And we have been working together, of keeping each other accountable for things. And she said something that I think was so true. Like, all these amazing coaches are doing these brilliant things, but in isolation. And how much could we do if we came together? Not for everything, but for more projects. And I think that's something that I've really taken on board this year. That when us as coaches come together, it's also just such a great collaboration, because we're all so emotionally sensitive. Well, we're sensitive to each other, and so generally tends to work together really well.
Yeah. And I think coaching is a really interesting industry, in that it really is quite collaborative, in a way that you kind of say competitor, and actually everyone is doing the same thing and trying to create broadly the same change. And actually, to your point, also acknowledging that there'll be some people that I speak to and I go, I'm not the best coach for you. And if I didn't know any other coaches, actually, I can't do the service that I could do by going, well, maybe you should talk to Chloe or to Caitlin. And you talked about that kind of working with more coaches. What are the next steps on that for you and your coaching work in general?
Yeah, so I've spoken a bit about the stuff that I do with individuals and the group work. And then the other side of the business is working with companies. And so, again, to kind of create coaching cultures from the ground up, not just from the top down. And it's fantastic. I really, really enjoy it. And I like working with sort of fewer companies, but at depth. So the idea is that you kind of become part of the furniture of the companies that you work with. And so a number of the companies that I've worked with for a few years, we sort of know everybody in the company, and you can have a real context. So when you're coaching somebody, you've got a bit of the context. So I know that can be something quite difficult with executive coaching, is that you're just seeing them, maybe their manager pops in for the first and last session, but it's quite difficult to feel their context. So I have found that the depth of relationship over a long period of time has really benefited a coaching relationship with an organization. And so as we've got more company clients, we're starting to build out the team of coaches. And so for each company that comes in, we sort of work out, okay, who wants to work with this kind of organization. And so the Coach Life team will sort of expand and contract depending on the work that we've got. And that's the sort of the vision for the next year is to almost, I'm grateful to do so much coaching over the last 6 years. And I'd quite like to almost try my hand at more like the kind of operational side of things, and to build communities of coaches and bring them together and working together on different, with different companies. And what we do with organizations, we don't just kind of plop coaches in. We do a design phase. So we'll go in and we'll really like get to know the company, do surveys, speak to people one-on-one, do interviews, speak to the senior leadership. And then based on all that information, design a program of training and coaching that reflects the culture. Because I think so much of the time it's that kind of cookie cutter, let's just kind of put coaching in. Whereas we almost try to coach as if the organization's an individual. Be like, right, let's get to know you. Let's like contract, let's set some goals, let's like check in at different periods of the coaching. How is it working? How is it impacting the culture? Is it working? And so my sort of, I guess, vision would be to have other coaches taking the lead on these kinds of projects, And also with the other side of the business, with the group coaching program, to have other coaches deliver those coaching programs as well, because and then maybe to, I think we were thinking of doing like a bit of a, try to do like an online course, which I think you can do with career coaching slightly easier because you can sort of put values and purpose and strengths and things like that. So there's like certain areas that are a little bit more, I guess, directive in career coaching, not all the time. And so it would be great to have maybe some coaches facilitating the course. And so the idea, and this is almost from a selfish point of view, just because I really, really missed working with people. And so it's been amazing. And actually, to have so many inspiring coaches that you're working with is it like elevates you like immeasurably.
And that it's really interesting you talk about the one-to-one and the company business kind of work, and really love that analogy of almost seeing the company as just one organism or person and getting to know them to be able to support it. How did, because obviously you said you started one-to-one, how did that company stuff, that group stuff come about?
So the group stuff came about because I was trying to, well, I also realized that one of the limitations of coaching is obviously you're trading your time. So there's only an amount of hours that you had in the day. So the kind of obvious step was to be like, well, can we coach more people at the same time, which is why we tried the pilot, which went really, really well. I think because it's a career coaching, people have really benefited being in a community and seeing other people's journeys, and it gives them the kind of, gives them accountability, but it also gives them a sense of, oh, I'm not alone. I'm not alone in this. Other people have access to these kinds of challenges as well. So that was the way that I actually just did one post on LinkedIn, which was extraordinary, because I said, look, I'm going to do a pilot. Is anyone interested? What about 50 people message to be like, oh, I'd love to be involved. So it's like, it was quite extraordinary that the appetite was there. And the company stuff has been, again, a lot through LinkedIn. LinkedIn's been really powerful for me. LinkedIn is sort of what other social media platforms were maybe 10 years ago, and that the reach you can get on a LinkedIn post is like thousands of people, whereas on Instagram you'll reach, you know, your followers and you won't really go past there. So I think two or three of our main company clients have been actually through just posts that we've done on LinkedIn. So that's been brilliant. And then also when people have left a company that you've worked at, they'll go to a new company and they'll be like, oh, we had coaching at our last company, and this is the organization. So it kind of grows quite organically. And then also what I imagine might happen, maybe the other coaches on the team will be like, oh, I've got a company that I used to work for. And so it feels a little bit more organic, the company growth, when I get sort of people reaching out who are interested.
And this is maybe super specific, but I think comes from a previous conversation we've had, some guidance you gave me. Am I right in thinking that a lot of those posts, I think for coaches, they're like, what on earth do I put online?
Yeah.
A lot of that work came through some of the videos you did.
Yeah. Yes, they did. I need to do more of them. But they did at the beginning. I was, during the pandemic, I was quite, I stuck to doing kind of one or two videos a week, just not even talking about anything that related to what I did. It was just like, oh, like I learned this today, and or I, is this coaching model that's really interesting. And video content on LinkedIn is very, very powerful. And photos are very powerful of people. I struggle a little bit with that. But I know that if you work with like a LinkedIn specialist, they will tell you that, yeah, photos, videos, brilliant, people. And we've recently brought a content person on, content designer, content creator on board to help us to design, develop the content. And that's been amazing. And actually, I think that, as I mentioned before, I think I'm a bit of a control freak, and I know that's quite a normal thing with a business. But I think last year has been such a, like, I've really learned to let go of that and to delegate and to bring other people involved. And one thing I was thinking about recently was how I wish I'd done that 2 years ago. And the key is, like, outsource before you're ready. Outsource before you have the money to outsource. Because I didn't. And but then you outsource, and then you create so much space for yourself, and then you create business because you have more space. But there's a really quite frightening critical threshold where you can kind of do everything. You don't really have the money to bring other people on board. But that's exactly when you should, because it's a bit scary, but it will give you the space to, yeah, just to do the things that you want to do. And honestly, it is the nicest feeling to know that people that you trust are doing the work, so, A, that maybe you don't want to do, or that you don't have the expertise to do, or, and B, that you don't have the expertise to do. And you get so much, it's a very nourishing feeling knowing that also that the business is still running when you're not there. So that's been such an amazing lesson this year for sure.
Yeah. The analogy really is an analogy. It probably is just what it is, but is that framing it more as that investment, isn't it? Of like, this will, this feels like scary because I can't quite do it, but the possibility that it creates will potentially mean that, you know, there's a richness that comes both, not in terms of more business, but the fact that it gives me the space to do these things that mean that I do more and better work probably than the things that give me less joy.
Absolutely. And actually, one of my coaches talked about, I can't remember what he described it as, like dragon syndrome. And I'm a big fan of Lord of the Rings, and I always imagine, like, the Hobbit, you've got the Smaug, the dragon, who's sitting on this big pile of gold in the mountain and keeping the gold warm, and he's just there, like sort of a miserly attitude. And we can become a bit like that when it comes to money, especially with our businesses, especially with and also when signing up to getting coaching as well, we can be a bit like, oh, I don't know. And I'm always quite conscious of that. It's like, what better use is this bit of money going to go to, other than like back into the business and back into what I love to do? But we've got to try to not become that dragon that's just kind of keeping this pile of gold warm. And of course, we want to save and we want to be secure, but there's a balance of dragon to, I don't know, just like just security. So I always think about that. If ever I'm like, oh, it's a lot of money, I don't know if I want to invest, I kind of think about the Smaug.
Mm-hmm. This is also my reflection, not necessarily the case for you, but I think that sense of control can also come into it in that, because we've worked so hard to create this sort of semi-abundance, and then it's like, well, if I reinvest this, what could it create, and am I good enough for it? Well, that probably comes up for me, so that's my reflection. But then, yeah, how will I navigate this new thing that, having got to grips with this thing I know will give me this nice bed of gold to lie on? There's an opportunity that I could have an even bigger bed of gold amongst other things, but like, oh my gosh, am I worth that, or can I even manage that?
Yeah, which makes me think of the fear of success as well as the fear of failure, and which I didn't really come across that until maybe a couple of years ago. And that actually the fear of success is just as common, if not more, of like, well, what if it works out? And then I have to do all these things, and then what if I'm not able to do them? And it's a very interesting thing to check in with, because they can feel quite, I don't know, they can feel quite similar, can't they? The fear of failure, fear of success. And yeah, it's essentially just us underestimating ourselves and us wanting to, our lovely brains trying to keep us safe and in the comfort zone.
Yeah, it makes me think, it kind of came to mind when you talked about, oh, it could be the quarter life opportunity. That's probably as terrifying as a quarter life crisis, just for a different group of people, in that fear of success, fear of failure.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's exactly what it is. It's like, yeah, it's a great parallel to make. And that depending on the person's map of the world, those different terms, what the quarter life opportunity could be even more scary than the quarter life crisis, depending on what frightens you more, fear of success or fear of failure.
Yeah. I'm conscious of our time. I've got a question from Robbie that I'd love to ask, because I think it's a really interesting one, and also a question, kind of some really practical things, guidance, and I think some of that's already come up. Maybe before that, is there anything we've not touched on that you'd really love to speak to?
I think maybe one thing just about, I know a lot of the people that I speak to are really curious about working remotely and working abroad and what that means for you and also what that means for your business. I live between Barcelona and London, but spend most of my time out in Barcelona. I moved here about a year and a half ago. I was actually only supposed to come for a summer and then realize it's rather nice living next to the sea. And I think a lot of other coaches and young coaches, I know that people in the group, and that's another thing to touch on as well, is we have this WhatsApp group, Alex and I are in, where we basically every month we meet on Zoom and we kind of informally mentor each other about building our own coaching practices. And a lot of people on the everyone's in their 20s and 30s, and a lot of people on the WhatsApp group are like in Lisbon and or traveling in Bali or in Mexico. And it's interesting. So I think the young coaches community are quite nomad-y. Not everybody, but there's quite a few people that like tend to want to travel. And so that's something to kind of maybe think about, the impact of moving abroad and what that's been. And obviously for me, like I do like 80% of my work online still from the pandemic. And that is challenging, you know, because I miss doing face-to-face stuff. But I go back to the UK to do some like in-person stuff and check in with the companies, and then the other coaches sometimes will go into the organizations. So, but for me, it's been worth it to be able to live somewhere that you really want to. And I feel like moving here has made me prioritize my lifestyle in a way that I didn't when I was in London, which I think has made me a lot more calm, hopefully, a lot more calm and a lot more, and then possibly also a lot more present with my clients. And also because this is, I guess, moving out here has been a bit of a like me writing my own story as well, and not just doing what was maybe the obvious path, which was like really scaling in London. And so it has its challenges, of course, but I think it hasn't negatively impacted the business. And I think that's like an important thing to note. And it means that you're a little bit more intentional about the things that you do choose to do. Yes, there are some opportunities that you can't, that pass you by, but not that many. I've not found that many. And if it's, I'm coming back to London on Monday to do some like management training for a company, because it's a company that's really, really interesting. And so if it's worth it, you'll find a way to do it.
I'm instantly brought back to the jam donut, and it sounds like there's been a period where it's like, I feel like Barcelona's giving me a bit more jam and I need a bit less dough right now.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Although you would be a little bit careful here, because you can just turn into a complete, you can get very jammy very quickly. So you have to be a little bit careful and mindful of who you surround yourself with. And actually, when I first moved here, I was very much like, I wanted to focus on lifestyle, because I'd worked in the pandemic, and all my 20s was trying to get this business to work. And so I moved to Spain. It was like, oh, okay, I can kind of actually put my lifestyle first. And so for a year it was like a really beautiful year of doing other things and learning outside of my work. And then actually in the last 6 months I've been like, okay, I'm ready to dive back in and to really challenge myself again, which has been amazing. So yeah, I'm sure there's people listen who've moved abroad and done things like that, and it's definitely teaches you so much about your own resilience and resources.
And it really feels like, as you say, writing your own journey is going along the path that you really want to support your clients to do, and being aware that that is going to be a constantly evolving thing. So it's kind of like, support my clients now unfolding, I need to unfold myself. And thinking about kind of what's unfolding, Robbie had a really lovely question, I think, around kind of your work in the quarter life crisis. And so, when we've talked about it, we talked about it in an age dynamic, and at some point you won't be within that age bracket. So what do you envisage your relationship being with that work, and what else might be present to you on the horizon?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I think at the beginning, I was a bit fearful of like, oh God, what happens? And would I just go quarter life, half life, three quarter life? You never know. But I think that this will always be a branch of the business, and maybe it will be somebody else taking over. Maybe it will be, or maybe it won't matter, and that it'll be like, as I said before, to have more of an operational role and to kind of keep bringing in other young coaches who are like in that, like within that experience. Although that's not necessarily a prerequisite to working with those in their 20s and 30s. But I can imagine there's a number of things that really interest me. I'm really interested in like the identity of mothers. I'm not a mother yet, but the identity of mothers going back into the workplace. And I can imagine that could be something that I'd focus on at some point. I'm really before I started coaching, I worked in Peru in equine therapy. So they use horses for therapy of disabled children. And I was really interested in the work with like working with animals, working with the nature, something in that space. I mentioned it today, but like the kind of existential coaching is really fascinating. And that's something I can really see maybe going down a little bit more depth. I've always really enjoyed working with the teenagers and young adults in the charities that we've worked with before. So again, that could be another part. I guess this is, again, coming full circle back to what we said at the beginning, the kind of emergent living. I don't really have an end goal of what the company will look like. I know that at this point, I kind of want to take a little bit of a step back and bring other coaches together, but I'm keeping it sort of quite open. And this is probably a terrible business mindset to have, but kind of crossing that bridge when I get to it, rather than worrying too much about what will unfold. I just get the sense that something will unfold regardless.
Yeah, which feels, as you say, coming full circle to that sense of emergent living.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, maybe the last thing to just pick your brains about as we come to a close is those practical things, which I think you've shared some really lovely nuggets of in terms of your experience starting a business. And also doing it when you don't necessarily have the foundation of a load of professional networks. What one thing that comes to mind that I'd be really curious on is how your work's evolved in terms of things like pricing, in the sense of starting out working and living from home, but also, you know, being in your early 20s and that gaining the sense of credibility that you talked about. How has that evolved?
Yeah, so I think coaching is it's an amazing profession for so many reasons. And one of those reasons is that you can earn enough to thrive in your life. And I've met coaches who've earned £150,000 a year to £300,000 a year. And it really, there is no, I don't think there's really a cap on how much you can earn. I found my relationship with money at the beginning really difficult, and charging people incredibly uncomfortable, and talking about money incredibly uncomfortable. But I think that's something that we need to work on in the coaching industry, to be a little bit more transparent about it. And so I have with my individual clients, I have a way of charging where I charge people depending on how much they earn. And that could be from anywhere between £150 for an hour to £300 an hour. And also when I work with organizations, it would usually be between £250 to £350 an hour. And so I quite like the opportunity to, so that somebody can choose almost how much they're being charged. I think it's just the key thing that I try to think about is, like, I never want to go away from a session and feel like, oh, you know, I don't think I'm getting paid what I'm worth. It's such a horrible feeling when you undercharge yourself. And equally, it's a very uncomfortable feeling when you feel like you've overcharged yourself, where you feel actually you're doing some work that you're like, I don't know whether this is like fair necessarily. That's not happened to me many, many times, but there's been like a few projects where it's like, this feels like a lot. So it's really a feeling that you get, I think, when you either feel a little bit disappointed or a little bit uncomfortable, that can help define how much you charge. But as something you said, Alex, is like, what we forget is that when you say you're a coach, you're also a business owner. And I think that business mindset is something that is a real challenge for people. It certainly was for me when I set out.
And I think it's a really interesting point you raise there of what feels right is what's going to allow you and your business to thrive. And for some people, that'll be something that gives them a salary of hundreds of thousands of pounds, and for others that won't be the case. And it's about recognizing what's right for you, so that you go into those sessions thinking, I've really been of service, and that's been recognized as well.
I absolutely can agree more.
All right, I'm conscious of time, and I feel like we could do another 2 hours on this. Maybe the last thing to touch on is, you mentioned it a couple of times, the Young Coaches WhatsApp group, which you're probably gonna have to change the name of after our conversation about Young
Coaches. I know, exactly. Gosh, we need some brainstorming.
But if people are curious about that group, what would you say? What would you recommend that they do?
Yeah, well, maybe just send me, or even if you're happy to, you an email. Anybody who's in the group, if they know. My email address is just chloe@quarter-life.co.uk, and essentially it's a very chilled group. It's not like pinging all the time, but every month we'll do a little Zoom call and just talk about our experiences. It's very free flowing, often just kind of sharing either woes or successes. But what I'm loving about it is that people are creating like alliances. And I see some people doing podcasts together, and some people like doing some training sessions together. And it's one of my favorite things, that the favorite parts of my month is those sessions. Just ping me an email if you want to get involved. I'll just add you to the WhatsApp group.
Thank you, Chloe. And for those listening and don't have a pen and paper to hand, that email will also be in the show notes. Yeah, Chloe, thank you so much for your time. It's been really wonderful, I think, both exploring your journey, but also seeing this theme of like emerging living as you talk about working remotely, moving to Barcelona, and exploring how your business is going to evolve and bringing in different coaches in different ways. It's just felt really enriching to hear how a coaching business can evolve with the coach. I'm taking away a lot, and I'm sure listeners will. Thank you very much, Chloe.
No, thank you. And as I said before, I it feels sort of poetic that we're doing this together. And as I said, I couldn't think of anybody better to do podcasting as a host. You've got such a powerful way of connecting things together and listening so deeply. So it feels very special to have done this podcast, but also to have done it with you. It's just like it's like a really, really meaningful experience. So thank you.
Bye-bye.
Hi, everybody. Robbie here. I'm the creator and founder of The Coach's Journey, and I've just got a few quick things to share with you before you go on to whatever else you've got going on in the rest of your day. Thanks so much for getting all the way to the end of this episode. I'm imagining that means that you think the work we're doing is important, and we think so too. And that's why I want to tell you about three ways to support The Coach's Journey and help us continue to support coaches to create thriving businesses and to thrive as they do it. The first is to become a supporter of the show. That means you give a small amount of money every month and help us to make more episodes and help those episodes reach more coaches. And in exchange, you'll get various benefits, including being the first to know about future plans and getting the chance to ask questions of upcoming guests. You can do that. Become a supporter at patreon.com/thecoachesjourney. The second is to join the Coaches Journey community. That's my flexible, affordable group coaching program for coaches. You pay between £20 and £100 a month and get access to a certain number of group coaching calls every year, plus some one-to-one time with me if you're a full member, and various other benefits. And of course, as part of that, you get the chance to be connected to other amazing coaches on their journeys too. You can join the Coaches Journey community at thecoachesjourney.com/community. Lastly, if neither of those things is right for you right now, please click subscribe or follow wherever you're listening to this podcast. That really makes a difference to us being able to continue to keep this show free. Thanks so much to everyone who has supported The Coach's Journey over the years, but in particular, thank you to Alex Witten, David Norris, Jessica Jem, Joey Owen, and Ruth Saville for your ongoing support. Thank you, too, for listening, and we hope to have you back with us on The Coach's Journey podcast sometime soon.